going to lighten things up by starting with the Titanic. Great one to end the day with. And this presentation is part of a more detailed paper that I'm working on, which examines the invocation of Belfast Titanic heritage in Titanic Belfast, the multi-million pound visitor attraction that opened in 2012. But itself is part of a broader investigation into how and why, in the wake of the Good Friday Agreement, heritage, the arts and culture have been employed as mechanisms for social and economic reconstruction in Northern Ireland. And I'm starting with Titanic Belfast because I think it's significant, because it provides a really striking example of what is actually quite a very typical kind of public-private arrangement in the cultural sector that pursues a range of highly political objectives under the banner of commemorative heritage and cultural memory practices. So the starting point then is, for me, it's an assumption that you all know about Titanic and Belfast and are probably bored to death. So I'm going to start with that. And the main focus of this presentation really is to look at the way that the ideas that emerged from the peace process for managing conflict through neutralising or channelling contested histories actually have become highly influential in shaping arts and cultural policy in Northern Ireland. And the way I see them, these ideas are highly coercive and highly manipulative strategies which attempt to impose a very narrow definition of identity. And I think they've had an enormous baleful effect on the way arts, culture, and what I'm going to talk about, cultural memory and heritage, is practiced here. It's changed the way that we think and talk and encounter culture in the north. Titanic Belfast, in a nutshell, well, it emerged amidst the wave of Titanic mania that swept the world in the run-up to the centenary of the liner's sinking. It cost in excess of £100 million. It's Belfast's new iconic attraction, and it promises to deliver a world-class experience to 400,000 visitors annually, while paying homage to those who perished. I'm quoting here. Paying homage to those who perished and those who built the ship by telling their stories. And this juxtaposition of the consumerist and commemorative language in the descriptions of Titanic Belfast, I think, is fairly typical within contemporary heritage practice. John Wilson Foster has defined heritage as history that is shareable. And he notes there's a very dangerous proximity between history that is shareable and saleable. So what is shareable and what is saleable? And the visitor attraction is actually just a cornerstone of a much more ambitious £8 to £10 billion waterfront development. It's operated by Titanic Water, which is a subsidiary of the Dublin-based Harcourt Developments, which has a £16 million investment in the visitor attraction and is also responsible for promoting the development of the site. And Titanic Belfast is separately owned by the Titanic Foundation, which is a limited company with charitable objectives whose principal aim is to educate people on Belfast's social, historical, industrial and maritime heritage through the story of Titanic. And its remit also includes developing the former shipyard as an authentic maritime heritage destination and shared space, through preservation of maritime heritage assets, which will enhance the authenticity of the destination. Now, the tension at the heart of this contractual relationship between Titanic Water Limited, who run Titanic Belfast, and Titanic Foundation, the charity, who actually own it, I think raises really important questions about the meaning of Titanic Belfast, either as the centrepiece of the biggest waterfront regeneration project in Europe, or as an authentic maritime heritage site. And I think that this is expressed, whether you see it, the focus is on the visitor experience in Belfast's new iconic signature building, or whether it's about Titanic trails and connecting and celebrating to the East Belfast communities where which built the Titanic. Belfast's rediscovery of Titanic has been linked to three very powerful forces. Firstly, the political imperative to discover a unifying identity which could drive Northern Ireland's reconstruction. Secondly, the global fascination for revisiting the past and the, not least, the more traumatic moments in human history. And thirdly, the economic opportunities that were presented by the global success of James Cameron's blockbuster Titanic. And a number of commentators have noted the striking reversal in previously negative attitudes which occurred in the wake of the film's Northern Irish release, which just happened to coincide with the final negotiations for the Good Friday Agreement. But I want to argue that in providing a conduit for new ideas about managing conflict, the politics of the peace process from its very earliest days played a fundamental role in shaping the ideological and cultural landscape from which commemorative projects like Titanic, Belfast, and there are others, from which they were to emerge. Starting then in the late 1980s, state security remained a top priority. But many of the challenges facing Northern Ireland were beginning to be understood as typical of declining post-industrial regions all over the Western world. New economic regeneration models were emerging in response to instabilities arising from the deindustrialisation that was taking place in Britain during the Thatcher period. And they were being adopted as part of Britain's economic and social war against the IRA. So Sir Richard Needham, former Parliamentary Undersecretary of State at the Northern Ireland Office, spelled it out when he said the key thing was to make Northern Ireland become normal. And in making it normal, the challenge for the IRA would be to destabilise it without the blame being cast on their shoulders. And the political strategy then was to secure the reinvention of urban Ulster as normal, placeless, able to hold its own in a competitive global economy. And you can see that Titanic Quarter's ambition to build a city of urban villages designed to imbue a sense of safety in public space is really a kind of reworking of these earlier ideas for normalising the city by containing or neutralising the past. And Eric Kuhn, the concept design architect for Titanic Quarter, has talked about an encounter or encounters he had with groups of mainly middle-class people, former residents of Belfast, who talked about wanting to return but needing to feel safe and part of a community. William Neal has described the Titanic Quarter plan as a Belfast urban idyll, suggesting that Kuhn's vision speaks to a rural idealism that continues to hold cultural sway in both nationalist and unionist representations of place. So in this sense, the allure of Titanic and the Titanic Quarter, although it's coloured by a kind of dreamy nostalgia, mainly expresses an aspiration to transcend the city's troubled past through the construction of a post-sectarian, placeless urban culture, where those who enjoy, and quoting again from Eric Kuhn, where those who enjoy the necessary lifestyle opportunities, we know what that is, may finally put history behind them. And I think that's really the kind of state-sponsored forgetting that was talked about before. 1997, New Labour's election victory marked another significant phase in the peace process and actually brought a new, very different set of ideological perspectives to the same problem: how to manage the past, how to contain political instability. Strongly influenced by the communitarian politics of the Third Way, New Labour approached Northern Ireland's post-ceasefire political crisis as a heightened and more violent form of the general crisis of political authority and social stability that was facing the UK. And I think in this sense, the Good Friday Agreement effectively placed Northern Ireland right at the heart of the New Labour political project. And it became a testbed for new social, economic and cultural policies aimed at reconstructing society and the economy in a new globalised world. And significantly, the process of reconstructing the public realm was frequently framed in terms of partnerships, partnerships between the state and civil society. And it was seen in this way of partnership rather than an imposition from above. And it was often expressed in the therapeutic language of empowerment. And then in that way, the Third Way proved very amenable to a lot of different groups in Northern Ireland, and particularly on the cultural left. It offered a retreat from judgment. There was no longer any need to take sides. And this chimed with, I guess, postmodern sensibilities in the arts and the academy. It seemed to offer bottom-up alternatives to the old confrontational problems of nationalism and unionism, and a softer, nicer alternative to the market-orientated policies of the more neoliberal models. However, this expression of third-way thinking in the cultural sphere, I think, started to take on a much more interventionist, coercive character. As political interest shifted away from structural political questions into ways of managing conflict in the cultural and even in the private sphere. And in Northern Ireland, that meant placing the politics and management of difference at centre stage. So we moved away from transforming society to thinking about how we could transform individuals to make them fit better into the society that we had, building their capacity, building their resilience. Within 2 years, in 2000, Belfast City Partnership Board, if you remember them, had published a 25-year strategic plan, 25 years, which was setting out its vision of a shared future for the city, where the problems of the past are channeled positively to create solutions. Creative city-making required partnership between government, business and communities to address the challenge of living in diverse cities. And in contrast to the earlier regeneration models, one of the key goals of creative city-making was to improve the quality of urban living by making cities more authentic and less placeless, drawing attention to historic concepts of neighbourhood and community. The new strategy was aimed at rekindling collective memories of a more civic past through appeals to traditional symbols. And so the rhetoric then moved away from the idea of normalisation towards ideas of exploiting people's emotional attachment to places and periods from the past as a mechanism for building civic and community cohesion. It led to a situation where collective and even personal memories were being understood as objects of political interest. And at first sight, this idea of reconnecting Northern Ireland to its past as a way of building a shared future seems hopelessly at variance with the actual lived experience here, past and present. Amidst endless disputes around the legitimacy of traditional parades, flag flying and commemorations, you think it would be more credible to say that the people of Northern Ireland are not so much estranged from the past as prisoners of the past. But as local artists and community activists really took ownership of these ideas of urban memories as signifiers of place, they became embedded, these ideas, in cultural practices linked to re-imaging strategies aimed at tackling visible signs of sectarianism in local communities, replacing paramilitary murals with cultural and historical memorabilia. In positively challenging contested histories within and between local neighbourhoods, it was argued that re-imaging would allow people to explore their identity, and it would promote tolerance and understanding and help to build collective frameworks of remembrance. Titanic Belfast's high-profile launch on the centenary of the ship's sinking marked the prelude to Ireland's decade of commemorations, the dramatic series of centenaries that marking events which shaped the sense of British and Irish identity in the 20th century. 15 years on from the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, the fulfilment of its promise for a truly historic opportunity for a new beginning just seems more distant than ever. And while some argue that the contested nature of the decade of commemorations provides opportunities for people to engage in intercultural dialogue around culture, identity, rights, and what we mean by democracy and the nature of political change, I think for many people living and working in Northern Ireland, there is a real fear that the continued fallout from our shared historic differences will actually provoke a further deterioration in community relations. So I just want to finish with this thought. The problem, I think, lies in the way that cultural practices have become embroiled in political and ideological projects focused on managing and containing instability in post-conflict Ireland. And there's a problem in the way that political intervention in the cultural sphere compromises artistic autonomy. But I think there is a bigger problem, a political problem, in that we are allowing the separate sphere of culture to be colonised by a particularly coercive and interventionist style of politics, which has narrowed the ground upon which citizens and artists and academics can freely come together to challenge the political orthodoxies of our time and to challenge what Malachy called the ideas that have expired.